Pod, we're back.
We're really back. We're not absent anymore.
No. And after this pod, we're going to be consistent again.
Here's the thing. We do need to catch up or not. I've had health problems. I didn't have COVID. I should say that. It wasn't COVID.
Don't say health problems in the middle of a global pandemic.
I really shouldn't say that. I'll just say, I had mono. There's no exciting story. I accidentally drank from my friend's cup. But that's a lesson for everyone. Just don't do it. Just keep your beverages to yourself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's where I've been. That's why I had mono. That's partially the reason. We were literally about to film a pod one day and I was about to fall asleep. I thought I had narcolepsy. It was kind of a big deal. Catherine, how have you been?
I've been busy as per usual. A lot of college app stuff. I've been working on my Common App since April, and I've only had, like, 4 essays done.
Woo! So, we love it here!
None of which being any supplementary essays, may I say. So, very busy. Activities are kind of starting back up for me. So, I've been working a lot with, like, my activities and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, it's been busy, but it's been good.
You know what else happened in our absence? AP score releases.
Oh my gosh! Oh gosh, depression.
Depression.
Depression. Dude, okay, if Mr. S is watching this, I don't know if I even told you. When we had a meeting with him, because we're working with him and some other teachers for like history stuff.
Which is good, student teacher collaboration.
Right.
But yeah, continue.
And I got a 3 on my A push. I cried. Bald is a better word.
Uh-huh.
He pointed at me and goes, I feel like you would have gotten a 4 or 5. And when I say,
when she wrote the most profound essay on slavery.
Oh no, it was trash. I'll say it.
I thought she wrote like a good essay.
No,
so
if nobody else will say it, I'll say it. It was trash.
So I did get Catherine a gift to make her feel better.
No, you didn't.
It's a re-gift. Don't feel too like.
Okay, I was like.
But it's a little plaque card.
That's so cute.
And what does it say? What does it say? What does
it say? This girl can't.
It's pink and it's sparkly and it says this girl can't. So I'm giving it to her.
I love it.
Because someone gave that to me as a gift. And I said, I don't know what I'd do with this.
So you give it to Catherine.
I'm going to give it to my friend who fits the associations for that perfectly.
I love it. I know exactly where I'm going
to
put it.
I love it. Okay. Other than that, like, the media work, it's my AP scores. So this is my beef with AP.
This
is my critique on the College Board. It's a $1 million industry, like, all this stuff. I, like, took 11 AP exams through the course of my 4 years of high school. 11. I didn't fail any of them. But I never once got a 5. Which, like, I can't complain about it. I got 3s and 4s on every exam that I took. A little heavier on the 4s. And I'm just like...
It sucks.
It
sucks. Like, getting a 3, I know, to anybody that's in AP or, like, is listening outside of, like, you know, knowing, a 3 is good. Like, objectively is good. But... when you think you're going to do better, when you're passionate about something, and you get a 3, it's like, oh, you're average. Good job.
It's
you're,
like,
average.
You're in the top 60% class.
I guess. Yeah. It's like, oh, good job, .. I guess.
You could have done better.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
So.
The only score that I'm personally proud of is my AP World score. That was my
girl
only 5.
Girl got a 5.
That's my only 5. Thank you, Miss Jamie Mansloten. And you are
Miss Jamie Mansloten. My mentor in life. That woman is my Becky Kelly. So Catherine and I tried this thing with this episode where we didn't tell each other what we were doing.
Because we were
like,
it's
been so, we still don't know. I'm excited to like tell her what I have because my story is like exciting. I'll just like drop a couple hints. We've got death.
Oh, word.
We've got an Irish immigrant.
Okay.
We've got, I'm trying to think here, big city corruption. And we have questionable job qualifications. That's my story.
That sounds like a fun
time. That lead to the death of hundreds.
Oh, word.
So okay. this is what I'm talking about. Catherine, like, do the same. Tell me, okay. Give me hints.
Okay, so my story is about a girl that could. This girl can.
Yeah. Oh.
A girl that definitely did, could, and would do it again. Bop, bop, bop. So I'll say it's kind of a feminist inspiration, I guess. It's kind of a little bit of
It's the story of the first Halloween.
No.
Oh. She told me she looked up a drunk history episode for this, and I was like, oh, okay. That's a fun drunk history episode, yeah. Though. If you have not seen it, I will recommend
I'll have to watch it.
So, yeah.
Oh, quick little thing. So, I'm starting to get into, like, theory. if you don't know what I mean by theory, I mean, like, I don't know how to say it. Like, political theory and, like, yeah. Economic theory.
Like, Marxist theory and stuff.
Yeah. And I don't mean, like, just Marxist theory, because if you don't know me, you know I'm anti-commie. oops. I just alienated, like, half of the people watching. They're like, fuck.
You think half of our audience
are communists? I don't know. I actually do not know. I don't know who watches or listens, whatever. But, yeah. I want to get in specifically into, like, economic theory. So if you have any recommendations, please do not hesitate to go to my Twitter, Catherine_461, and give me recommendations. I'm literally down for anything. I've already had people, of course, like, request me to read, like, Marx, and then also a lot of Keynes, and people said Kant, but I've heard that Kant is, like, super hard to read, so I'm kind of scared. But again, if you have any recommendations on what I should read, please, please do not hesitate to reach out. I'm down to read it.
Yes. Okay, so while Catherine's, like, trying to get into, like, these, like, intellectual, like, philosophical, like, minds and authors and stuff, I'm out here recommending everyone watch this documentary on Disney Plus about the making of Frozen 2. That's where I see, like, the two types of people.
Yeah,
like, it's so good. I cried a couple times. So yeah. The two types of people. It's called Into the Unknown. It's very fun. Aww. Quote, I look, it's my turn for the quote this week, and I thought it was only fair that we honor the late Representative John Lewis.
Yeah.
And I was, like, trying to pick a quote, and just one was too much. There's one that I just think, like, I just want to say, because it and he said, some of us gave a little blood for the right to participate in the democratic process.
Damn.
So I just, like, thought that was an important one, but this one I think is, like, too beautiful not to also say. So it says, never give up, never give in, never become hostile. Hate is too big a burden to bear.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So that is our tribute to the late Representative John Lewis.
May he rest in power.
We were just watching.
Oh my god.
We were just watching the ceremony in the news coverage of it and everything, and the beautiful prayer that was led. I was crying. Catherine was.
Yeah, I was bowing, like, head bowed. I was like
head bowed, Jesus. Nodding. And then
Jesus spoke through that man. Mm-hmm, the Holy Jesus Spirit came through him. Man.
It was really good. If you haven't gotten a chance, look that up. And then we were just watching that, and then we were like, oh, we should go film the pod. And then they said, and now the Honorable Mitch McConnell, and then we turned it off and left. Okay.
We're like, let's go.
We're like, that's enough. That's enough.
We don't need
for today. We're gonna go film our podcast now. So, with that, I think that'll wrap us up for today. Now get ready for a tale of murder and intrigue and girl power.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Sounds about right.
So yeah, and grab your snacks, relax, and enjoy this episode of History Time. Okay, everyone buckle up. Catherine was really proud of me because I actually, like, have a script for this episode.
When you texted me that, I was like, Blake, you're not reading off of Wikipedia? Clapping.
Hey, I have, like, I never just have one source, though. I will go, like, Milk Foundation.
He's diversified.
I, like, have tabs open.
Yeah.
And people are proud of me. Okay, so today, that's a high-pitched sound. Today we are talking about the Saint Francis Dam destruction.
I don't know about this.
So, the details. Right. These details are important. These details, fun fact, change. So listen to what I'm about to say.
Oh.
So, on March 12, 1928, over 450 people died. In the span of roughly what's estimated to be 65 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So there was no warning because it happened in the middle of the night. And this was supposed to be the man William Mulholland's greatest achievement, but was his demise in his career. So now, you're probably being like...
I have so many questions.
You have so many questions. You're probably like, who's this William Mulholland fellow? And he was born in Belfast, United Kingdom.
Okay.
So, like, he's a little Irish boy. He was born in 1855 on September 11th. So...
Already.
Already, we have this man who just, like, some omens here. Mm-hmm. So growing up, he had, like, all these fascinations and things, mm-hmm. as you do, you know, when you're, like, a boy. He had all these curiosity and stuff, and his parents worked hard or whatever. His yeah. parents were very, very hard on him. And he runs away at a young age, and guess why? Oh. Guess his reasoning for running away.
Why?
His dad beat him over a bad report card. He got a bad report card at school, and his dad beat him, and he ran away.
Oh, my gosh.
So, like... That's it must have been one heck of a beating, or, like...
Yeah, you wouldn't just run away from a little slap on the wrist, you know?
I think it happened in his teenage years, because then he goes on to join the British merchant fleet, which kind of puts him on the up and up, and he, like, has this ticket to, like, kind of move around. He crosses the Atlantic with the British merchant fleet, and as he's done there, he sticks around the U.S., and he moves from city to city. He lives in New York. He makes his way west, eventually ending in Los Angeles. Now at this time, like, Los Angeles wasn't huge yet.
Yeah.
And this is like started. This is in like around the 1870s. He's just chilling. He's like just hanging around. And at this time, like, people like the warmth, but like it's also like by the Joshua Tree. It's like desert. So it's on the up and up. And the big problem, too, of, like, why Los Angeles couldn't, like, grow as immediately right away is because there wasn't as much access to water.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, that, like, they have to have the resources for water to, like, in order to grow as a city and support and sustain the population. So, in the spring of 1878, that is fine. She is sipping on this.
On my water bottle.
Her water. Yeah. So, in the spring of 1878... William Mulholland is hired to be a deputy sanjero. How did I do?
You did well, actually. Okay. That was good.
Is that a word?
I think so, sanjero? Yeah.
I should have looked. See, this is like the fun thing. I should have like looked it up. Well, the word for ditches is sanjas. And his job, he was responsible for digging the ditches.
Oh.
So, look at him. So yeah, he's hired to, and this is meant for pipes for drawing water from the Los Angeles River.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, Los Angeles is beginning to grow, and now they need all this water supply. And it says he embodied, like, the American dream and, like, the American spirit, that he was, like, this immigrant who was, like, beginning to work his way up. He used his downtime and savings from being a sanjero to, like, get textbooks and educate himself on engineering, geology, hydrology, and mathematics. So he's, like...
The motivation.
He's self-taught. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. He is self-taught. Keep this in mind. So he's self-taught. Everything. He never has a degree. He never has, like, anything like that. He everything he knows, he learned himself.
I admire the motivation, but from what I know so far, I feel as if, though, this is not going to be good.
No. So he's self-taught. And then over the course of 23 years, he goes, like, he just rises the ranks of the company. He, like, works really hard to get where he is.
Okay.
He goes from sanjero, and then he becomes, like, a foreman. And then he earns the title of superintendent after 23 years with the company. So now... the Los Angeles mayor is Mulholland's former roommate.
Okay.
So we have some, like, patronage going on.
Yeah, some connections, networking.
He's really got the connections. And, so he works with this mayor, Fred Eaton, and Mulholland has this plan now, and he's like, I can bring more water to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And he's like... Mulholland thinks he's, like, really slick. He's like, I've been reading a lot on this city called Rome... And they had these things called aqueducts.
Wow.
Like, he literally is like, he's like, and like, he's like, Fred, aqueducts. Mm-hmm. And then Fred's like.
This is it.
Fred is like, oh my gosh.
King.
This is like, that's
give him a crown
that
him
is
king.
Such a good idea. So, he's like, you know what, Mulholland, go for it. You're the superintendent, do it. And so, There's a, it's described as clean and plentiful Owens Lake. It's 224 miles away from Los Angeles. And it's described as a bold legacy-defining plan that would lead Los Angeles into the future. So, the pipeline ends up being 233 miles, and it's completed in 1913. Mulholland, this is a quote, he said, "Only water was needed to make of this region a tremendously rich and productive empire, and now we have it."
So he really thought he had the key.
He's really like, he's acting like he invented water.
Yeah.
And
look at me.
Look at me, guys. He gives this like signal, like this giant thing, and that's the signal for the spigot to be turned.
Yeah.
And as the water spills out, this is a quote, he turns to the crowd and goes, "There it is, take it."
Oh, wow.
To the this water this, that's like,
she's like coming look from at his me. My from invention.
His from his 233-mile aqueduct, because he invented the aqueduct. However, not everyone loves his plan for the aqueduct, because what used to be, like, again, the rich and plentiful Owens Lake, California farmers are really pissed off about it, because now that it's draining their resources.
Oh, yeah.
And everything along this, like, multiple hundred mile, like, route, because he's, like, relocating the water to Los Angeles. So the farmers are angry about it, and some of them sabotage the aqueduct. And Mulholland sues them in 1924. So, like, 10 years after its completion, he's like, "I think people are trying to, like, dynamite the aqueduct. They're doing all this stuff."
And I love how dynamite was just, like, easily, accessible.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like this, so I'm gonna blow it up. Yeah. That was the mindset. I love it. You know what?
When was Mount Rushmore made?
Dude.
I'm kidding. That was satire.
Oh,
I don't like this. I'm like, gonna blow. I don't like this. I'm gonna blow it up with dynamite.
Oh yeah, for real.
That was a sound effect.
Let
okay.
No, I'm hearing you.
Yeah. So.
Madame.
After he successfully sues the farmers of California.
Just collectively, holistically, just like the whole thing.
Yeah, all five.
all five.
Like there's five of them or something. He then goes on to build five dams successfully, and all these dams.
Just in spite of those five ones.
Yep, for
just
real.
Each farmer.
Each farmer, you get a dam. So he goes and he builds these five dams. These dams are actually successful, and they do give even more water to Los Angeles, and they do encourage even more of a population boom because it's a beautiful, like, Los Angeles is a beautiful area. It's got the beautiful sun. It's arid, and now it's got all this water, so it can support a population. And then
not. Currently, but then...
yeah, way back when. Maybe if Mulholland were around today. So now he's like, okay, I've built these five dams successfully. I am now going to build my most ambitious project, the St. Francis Dam in the San Francisquito Canyon. So now he's like, this giant canyon. Like, I'm going for the big one.
I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. So in 1926... is when, on May 4th, 1926, that's when this is created. I have this website, waterandpower.org, and it's got all these, like, photos of, like, the dam and the canyon and things like that.
Yeah.
The construction began on March 9th, 1925. Almost a year to build this. The structure was over 205 feet high, 1,225 feet long on its crest, 150 feet long at its base, and 160 feet thick at the stream level.
Holy crap.
So,
I have no measure of anything, so honestly...
It's just, okay,
you could
just...
have said 3 inches, and I would have been like, wow.
Yeah, you can look it up, though. It's very big. So, it was built by the City of Los Angeles Bureau of Waterworks and Supply, under the supervision of its chief engineer, William Mulholland.
Self-taught, mister.
Yeah. The St. Francis Dam was given an anglicized version of the name of the creek on which it had rested, San Francisquito.
They made it white. That was a translation of that sentence.
Yeah. So the dam was originally designed to only be 175 feet tall and to hold back the reservoir of 30,000 acre feet. However, right after construction began, Mulholland decides to raise the dam 10 feet and increased the capacity to 32,000 acre feet. So since little construction had been completed, the minor changes, like minor changes were made to accommodate his change of plans. Mm-hmm. And then when in July, the dam's like halfway completed. Right. And Mulholland again is like, let's do another 10 feet.
Oh my gosh.
So now we're up like, now we're up 20 feet from the original plan. And they have to like create this thing for the western side of the dam called a wing dike. And that's to keep the dam from spilling over to accommodate the ridge where the reservoir would be filled.
What was his rationale for making it bigger? Just more water?
More water. And then he was... Let's also keep in mind, this is a man who doesn't have degrees. Everything he knows, he learned on his own. He has no certifications or qualifications for his job other than, like, the books and his career experience.
Also, I feel like we need to take mm-hmm. into account, like, the quality of his resources of the time. Because, like... You know, mm-hmm. He didn't have access to the internet. I mean, even people that are self-taught today, I would question anybody's, like...
Like, if you just, like, Catherine, could you build a dam right now?
No, I can't.
I couldn't build a dam right now.
I can't build a fort.
I can't build a pillow fort. Why? What makes you think you're building a dam? It's also funny, and it's not funny, people died. But, like, in the historical notes the of the project... In the historical notes of the project, it said, gravity dams like St. Francis use the weight... to resist the water pressure exerted on them. And so when the St. Francis Dam was increased from 175 feet to 195 feet without any substantial widening of the dam's base, changes would not occur with these changes wouldn't occur with modern engineering practices, but no one said anything in 1925, especially when it's William Mulholland who just sued these people, built five dams, and mm-hmm. is like
freaking, he's at the tippity top.
He's like Los Angeles's savior when it comes to stuff like this.
Interesting.
So yeah. It's a whole deal. So it gets filled to capacity 2 years after, completed. But first a little bit more about it. It's built into this sparsely populated mountainous canyon, and the canyon is 47 miles northeast from downtown Los Angeles. And in this area, the residents are like mostly farmers and workers, so again, Mulholland probably wouldn't like them. it's got these hydroelectric power plants that have all these workers that live nearby. They're just known as Powerhouse 1 and Powerhouse 2 because they weren't creative in their naming processes.
I guess.
At the time, it was the largest arch-supported dam in the world. It could hold over 12 billion gallons of water and about 2 years worth of water for the city of Los Angeles. So, like, let's say it didn't, like, there were no water resources available for Los Angeles. It would still survive for another 2 years. The project...
Do you know what the population in Los Angeles was at the time?
I don't. Okay.
That was just a random question. I don't know why.
Check the Twitter. I will post that on Twitter. I'll find the answer and post it on Twitter.
We'll post the, like... Oh my gosh, you know what we should... I'll cut this out, I promise. You know what we should do?
Don't cut it out. It's like a fun little sneak peek.
Okay. We should, like... Every episode we film, take pictures that relate to the episode, not say anything about what the episode is, and be like, find out. Click the link.
You see, and Catherine wanted to cut this out. I think that's fine. Okay. Another fun detail about Mulholland. So the St. Francis Dam cost $1.3 million to build, which is under budget for what they thought it would be. There's a very important note here. This is a tendency for any Mulholland-led project. All of his projects run under budget.
I don't like that.
All of his projects run under budget.
A bridge should not be under budget. Yep. I don't care.
So Mulholland himself opens the gate the morning of May 13th to fill up the reservoir at a rate of 70 million gallons a day. So, less than 2 years later, on the morning of March 12th, 1928, mm-hmm. there's this, the dam keeper, his name is fun, it's Tony Harnischfeger. Tony Harnischfeger.
Was he German?
I don't know. Italian, maybe? Something like Tony. That. He's doing his...
That's probably, offending someone.
He has to do daily inspections of the dam, and he finds something that's called distressing, and it says, a rather significant leak on the west abutment was pouring out muddy water, a potential sign the foundation was being washed away.
Oh, no.
So he calls Mulholland... Mulholland rushes to the site, accompanied by Deputy Harvey Van Norman, around 10:30 a.m. They inspect further, but they discover, much to their relief, the water wasn't muddy when they get there. So they're just like, oh, nothing's wrong. Like, this water's not muddy. It's just water. Like, it's just a leak. It's
fine. But there's still, like...
It's so they're just like, okay, it's not, and the quote is, it's not in immediate danger of collapse. Then it says they returned to Los Angeles and ate a, quote, late lunch, apparently unconcerned. Cut to 11 p.m. that evening, Harnischweger is doing his usual nightly inspection, and he's like, this was good. And then an hour later,
this is good.
An hour later, the dam breaks.
Oh my gosh.
So, estimates put the dam collapsing at 11:58 p.m.
58 minutes later.
Yeah. It is believed that Harnischweger, his girlfriend, and their son were the first ones to perish.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. There are no first-hand accounts. This is a quote from the Smithsonian article that I used. There are no first-hand accounts from anyone who actually saw the dam break. Anyone who did see it would presumably have been killed instantly.
Well, yeah.
So seconds later, the water takes out power lines and the San Francisco Canyon is in total darkness. However, it's 12:03 a.m., so there are, like, people are sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that much of a concern. This is another quote. It says, according to the official report by an independent commission, the liquid avalanche took out the concrete power plant 2, where a lot of the workers worked, and it said, crushing it, quote, as easily as an eggshell.
So, well, yeah, all that water pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
So get this. In one of the nearby communities, there were only 3 survivors. One of them was Ray Rising. His wife and 2 daughters did not make it.
Ugh.
So this is a quote from Ray. He said, in a 1963 article, or interview, he said, we were all asleep in our wood-framed home in the small canyon just above the powerhouse. I hear a roaring like a cyclone. The water was so high, we wouldn't get out the front door. The house disintegrated. In the darkness, I became tangled with an oak tree, fought clear, and swam to the surface. I was wrapped with electrical wires and held by the only power pole in the canyon. I grabbed the roof of another house, jumping off when it floated to the hillside. I was stripped of clothing, but scrambled up the razorback of a hillside.
Oh my gosh. That's so insane.
Let's recap. He's wrapped in electrical wires, hanging onto a power pole, jumps onto just like a floating roof of a house.
Fully naked, like, whilst.
Thing, and then he climbs up this hillside so he can be protected from the surge. So
that's insane. That sounds like a movie.
It literally, like, I, yeah. The water continues going from there because, like, it's this dam breaking.
Mm-hmm.
It moves at a rate of roughly 18 miles an hour. Causing damage to the towns of Castaic, Saugus, Fillmore, Santa Paula, and Saticoy. With each stop, the water's picking up more debris. I said debris. Okay. In my defense, I was going to say debris, and the next word is trees.
Okay.
That is my defense. So it's debris, trees, and casualties. So, the few that survived the initial crush grabbed onto anything that would float.
That must have been so terrifying. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. I do not know how to swim well.
Oh.
So, like, honestly, water is just scary mm-hmm. to me in general. But, like, imagine, like, 12 billion tons, you said?
Yeah.
Of water just...
12 billion tons. That's not correct, but it seems like it.
Well, like, what was the number? Didn't you say a number?
So, the... Well, when it was fully filled...
Okay.
It was built to 70 million... On May 13th, it was built to fill the reservoir at a rate of 70 million gallons a day.
Don't know where
and
I
then,
got 12 billion.
And then 2 years, but 2 years later. So, hang on, I could probably find it. Regardless,
it was
millions of gallons of water, yeah.
A lot of it.
That
was my point.
Yeah. And how, the first, like, warning didn't come out until 1:20 a.m.,
Jesus.
So, an hour and a half after the dam breaks. So, the towns that had already been hit did their best to warn others in the water's path.
Mm.
And there's these people called the Hello Girls. They're female telephone operators like Louise Guype in Santa Paula and Rysel Jones in Saticoy. They called residents in low-lying areas and warned them to get out. They saved some lives. California Highway Patrol officers One of them named Thornton Edwards earned the nickname Paul Revere of the St. Francis Flood.
Wow.
And this other guy named Stanley Baker crisscrossed streets on their motorcycles with their sirens wailing so people would, like, get up and leave.
Dang.
And now that... Now that the destruction has begun, we don't know when Mulholland found out that, like, his prized dam was destroyed. However, we know that there's a rumor that, like, when he found out, he said, "God, don't let people be killed. Please, God, don't let people be killed." And Mulholland and Van Norman reach the scene about 2:30 in the morning. They go to the dam itself at 2:30 a.m. They realize the extent of the damage. And this is a quote from Mulholland. He said, "We saw at once that the dam was completely out and that the torrential flood of water from the reservoir had left an appalling record of death and destruction in the valley below."
Mm.
So the water from the dam has a 55-mile journey to the ocean from the canyon.
Oh my gosh. No.
Yep. So the water, 55 miles, traveling roughly 18 miles an hour. So, the middle portion of the dam stayed intact, but, like, either side, all the water still spilled out.
Wow.
It's estimated 1,200 homes were destroyed, thousands of livestock were killed, and this pisses me off. Remember right at the beginning when I said, remember these details? I originally said 450 people were killed.
Yeah.
So this now says, "It is now believed that over 600 people perished due to many undocumented people who worked in the area but were never accounted for." So we have hundreds more that just, like, never got proper
acknowledgement.
Like, acknowledgement, yeah. Because they were undocumented.
That breaks my heart. Mm-hmm.
People immediately retaliate. Residents across the region put up signs in front of their house that read simply, "Kill Mulholland."
Oh.
So now is Mulholland's demise. People do blame him for not being qualified for his job.
I mean, he wasn't qualified at all.
Now people are saying, like, why is the dam 20, like, multiple stories higher than you originally said it was going to be? And so people petition for a coroner's inquest, and that happens. Witnesses testified to seeing leaks, drips, and cracks in the dam the days prior. A statement from William Hoke, who's a friend of Harnischfeger, indicated that Harnischfeger had made some remarks to the unsafeness of the dam and was told by some of the higher-ups that if he had wished to retain his position, he better stop talking about the dam as unsafe.
Oh my gosh.
Trained civil engineers explained how they, like, found problem. Oh, bless you. Oh, God, bless you. Okay.
I'm back.
She's back. So, trained civil engineers who have training and certificates and degrees and job qualifications.
Yeah.
They find the problems with Mulholland's design. And, they're just like, yeah, this dam was not up to code or standards. But, right. Like, this is a man who made 5 dams successfully and, like, is Los Angeles' savior and stuff. So, this is another quote here. It says, "Don't blame anyone else. You just fasten it to me. If there was an error in human judgment, I was the human. And I won't try to fasten it on anyone else. On occasions like this, I envy the dead."
I mean, he was definitely guilty.
Yeah.
Which, you know, doesn't change the fact people perish, but yeah. It gives some solace to, like, you know, he's not a heartless monster. He's just, you know, not qualified for the job.
And guess what? Mulholland says in response.
Huh.
He goes, "I think the dam had been dynamited."
Oh my god, no.
He thinks
I thought that quote was from him. The one you read prior, the one that guilty.
I did. It was. And then he later goes, "Actually, though, I think people tried to sabotage me."
Oh my god, no.
And,
He
said perhaps a callback to his days building the aqueduct. And, like, it's a very big thing, very vulnerable. So, and here's the other thing. If someone did dynamite it, no one would, there was no one there to see it.
Right.
He can, like, kind of say that, whatever. But after weeks of interviews, the inquest cleared Mulholland of any charges, but did declare that the construction and operation of a great dam should never be left to the sole judgment of one man, no matter how imminent, especially if that man doesn't have any qualifications.
Mm-hmm. As it should have been.
Yeah, commissioner's report, While also not blaming Mulholland of any intentional wrongdoing, adds the failure of the St. Francis Dam was due to defective foundations. So people blame, so like the public blames Mulholland, but like formally they don't charge him, which I think is...
He should have been charged.
Which I think is still oversight. It's 68 years later until Mulholland is like truly exonerated though, when in 1995, geological engineer... J. David Rogers concluded in his book that the dam had been partially built on an ancient landslide site which shifted under the massive weight of the dam. And he said, considering the technology available at the time, there's no way that Mulholland would have known about the gigantic landslide. Which I'm kind of like, I don't know that that's a... I don't know. He did, like, there's some questionable judgment there. So yeah, it's... There are still remains of the St. Francis Dam in the San Francisco Canyon. Nearby the haunting reminders, there's a sign that says, and I quote, on March 12, 1928, just before midnight, it collapsed and sent over 12 billion gallons of water roaring down the valley of the Santa Clara River. Over 450 lives were lost in this, one of California's greatest disasters. And that is the story of the San Francis Dam disaster. One more thing I'm gonna throw out there. St. Francis is the patron saint of the environment.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
So let's talk about it.
Okay.
Let's talk about people needing to be qualified for their jobs.
The illusion you just made. Okay. Wow. That's where we're going with it.
Especially... We're looking at you, Betsy DeVos. Let's look at people
just
who
not
are...
Just not even covering it up anymore, just like...
Let's holy. Oh, no, I'm going there. Let's talk about people who aren't... Who, like, think they're... Like, who have these job qualifications, but then, like, people die because of their actions.
Oh, word.
Especially when they're trying to, like, be economically savvy and keep their projects under budget. And they're trying to use the financial resources as, like, a motivation for, like, their greatness.
I think the part that's most telling... to like then and now is the fact that there will be no accountability. And the fact that even, you know, with the pretty words that he said at first, that Mulligan said at first, like, oh my gosh, I'm guilty, I am the man that is, you know, to blame, at the end of the day he still deflected to the people that he thought were easiest to blame.
He blamed the workers. He blamed, well, he was like,
yeah, he blamed the workers.
He was like, oh, they definitely blew up my dam that was through multiple sources and multiple qualified individuals was said to be a disaster based on like structural integrity as well as like geological formations. But no.
So
another fun fact, they're the richest houses in the world in Los Angeles are on a street called Mulholland Drive.
I mean, what?
So, yeah. Hello. Yeah, this is my sister, everyone. We're ranting.
Yeah.
Say hello.
Hi, Mrs. Vanslum.
If she's listening. So, yeah. Yeah, that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah.
You got anything to add? You want to talk about patronage or something?
Oh, yeah. Also, patronage, bad. That's all I got.
When your former roommate says, yeah, build an aqueduct. And the moral of this story is that aqueducts are bad.
Yeah.
That's it.
I think, yep, that's our biggest takeaway.
That's our biggest takeaway.
If you take anything from this, just don't build
that's
an aqueduct.
That's it. That's it. Okay.
And if you ever come into money, don't fund an aqueduct.
Don't fund an aqueduct. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the St. Francis Dam. If you have to take a break now, go ahead and do it. And then we're going to come back for Catherine's exciting story that I still don't know anything about. So, yeah.
I'm so excited for this one.
If you got to take a break. Good. If you got to take a break, do it. And we'll see you back here. Thank you.
Okay, buckle up because
we're back.
We have a tale of a bad bleep.
Addison Rae. Little Shardy the baddest.
And she got her ways.
She got her ways.
So today I'm going to be telling the story of Elizabeth Jane Cochran or her pen name, Nellie Bly.
I know of Nellie Bly.
You do?
I do.
No! I mean, I'm glad you know of her. She's really cool, but kind of sad. Because I thought
we stand a mental health queen.
Yeah, she was a queen. So Nellie was born Elizabeth Jane Cochran on May 5th, 1864. Her family basically owned a super lucrative mill in Pennsylvania. But when she was 6, her father passed away. And consequently, the family had to, like, move off their farm because they couldn't, like, upkeep it. And they couldn't really afford it. So this kind of catapulted their family into a lot of, like, financial turbulence. So that caused Nellie to not be able to finish her education. So Nellie was kind of forced to focus her energy on helping her mother run a boarding house. In 1885, however, Elizabeth's life would change forever. So Elizabeth decided to pen an open letter to an editor of the Pittsburgh Dispatch. She basically called out the editor for his negative representation of women in an article titled, quote, What Girls Are Good For. Let's take that in for a second.
Wait. Misogyny?
Mm-hmm.
Damn it.
Oh, no. In 1885? What? The article essentially just implied that women are not good for anything, so Elizabeth, like the queen she is, gave the editor a piece of her mind, and the editor was apparently so impressed that he literally printed her rebuttal letter on his newspaper and, like, offered her a job. Which, like, oh, is kind of, like, interesting. Like, would you accept the job if somebody, like, put yourself in
Elizabeth's shoes?
You would.
Okay, but if I were Elizabeth,
okay,
and I were a bad bleep Addison Rae to begin with,
right?
I would do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you're right. And it ended up working out really well. So she got offered the writing position, and she took it. So then she went under the name Nellie Bly. So I'm going to be referring to Elizabeth by Nellie from now on, because that was her pen name. So she started writing under the pseudonym. And she basically was kind of confined creatively to only writing for women, almost. Because, you know, at this time, in the historical context of it all, you know, editors still were like, no, like, you can't really write, like, quote, serious pieces, unquote. So she was really creatively confined to that. And this wanted, or this pushed her to want to pursue pieces that address both men and women. So, Bly began to search for a paper that would allow her to reach both audiences and just, like, overall write more seriously. So, in 1886, during this time, she was, like, looking for newspapers and stuff, but she somehow found the time to literally travel to Mexico and send back reports on, like, official corruption. Which, like, is very interesting, because, like, how, when, and, like, when did she have the time? Because she also did other stuff in 1886 that I'll talk about shortly. But she basically sharply critiqued, like, the government of Mexico, and this literally made them, like, expulse her out of the country. Like, they said, leave. So, these articles were subsequently collected in the 6 months in Mexico in 1887, which was released. And, yeah, she basically just called out, like, an entire country. And, you know.
And they probably just loved her because she was American.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. So, yeah, if you have any, like, concern of, like, who she was as a person, I feel like that encapsulates it. She didn't care. She's like, oh, a whole government? Cool.
Yeah.
So then, in 1886, she moved to New York City, and, again, she was finding it super hard to find work, but eventually, she ended up landing a job to work with Joseph Pulitzer.
Oh, if you've seen Newsies.
From the New York World, yeah.
Newsies. Yellow Journalism?
Yeah.
Sensationalism?
Yeah. So if you're not aware of who Joseph Pulitzer was, he's known for, like, yellow journalism in the
Mexican-American
War?
Spanish-American War.
Yeah.
Wait, Spanish.
No, Mexican-American War.
No, Spanish-American.
We're gonna settle this.
Guys, Catherine and I have a disagreement.
I might be wrong, actually, but
that was in 1848, I feel like.
Why are you right? Yeah, you're right.
Because I'm a history major.
So anyways.
Guys, I just did a backflip. You can't see it, but I did.
I swear.
Yeah, because it's been, that's when.
No, you're right.
They blew up the ship.
Yep. So.
Or did they?
Wait, this just took a turn.
We're not talking about that today.
So, yeah, Joseph Pulitzer, known for yellow journalism in the Spanish-American War. So she got a job there. And one of her first undertakings was basically this huge expose on the conditions of this Blackwell insane asylum.
There's a drunk hit. This is the drunk history episode she's talking about. Yep. It is so funny. If you guys get the chance, look it up.
Please do. It's literally hilarious. Like, I was dying. And there is this one part in it where she literally looks in a mirror and is like, I don't know what a crazy person is. So she literally just starts making faces in the mirror and goes, and like starts barking. Yeah. And she goes, this is
and then she, I think she like goes to the jail and they're just like, oh yeah, this girl's crazy.
Yeah.
She's crazy.
Yeah, it's literally hilarious. And so, yeah. By the way, I didn't understand that the Blackwell Insane Asylum was like an island. It wasn't just like a building. Nope. It was a whole island.
It's like Alcatraz.
Yeah. So she basically committed herself into this insane asylum, pretended to be insane, and like barked up people or something. In the drunk history episode, it was literally she walked into her mother's boarding house and started barking at people. And then they were like, yeah, go away. So that's how she got into the Blackwell Insane Asylum. And then, after 10 days, she finished up her, like, journalism, I guess, and she released 10 Days in the Madhouse. And this article basically, like, revolutionized what was New York, and, like, the New York world, I guess. Specifically, it says that the article precipitated a grand jury investigation of the asylum and helped to bring about a lot of the needed improvements in patient care. It was very much so, like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with, like, a lot of, like, the reform movements that came about, like, after, like, Gilded Age times. It was, like, huge stuff about, like, prisons and, like, you know, all that. But, like, this was really the start of, like, you know, we should maybe start treating people with, like, dignity.
Yeah.
So that's good. And then, again, a lot of the stuff was, like, a lot of the improvements that she made in patient care translated to, like, jails and a lot of, like, legislature. So she exposed bribery and a lobbyist system in this time. So, like, imagine this. This is, like, 1887. Yeah. She's a woman. And she's like, I don't care.
And to think she got her start because she was, like, ballsy enough to be like, right, your writing sucks, and the dude was like, you want a job?
Yeah, and it really followed her, because like she was ballsy enough to like call a random editor out, and then she was ballsy enough to do all the other stuff that she did. So she was made one of the most famous journalists in the United States, because clearly people were like, well, damn, this girl knows her stuff and she's not scared of anything. Her hands-on approach literally developed the practice that we now call investigative journalism, where people literally just go and, like, you know, investigate, I guess, like, it's, like, the name, but her, like, way of writing and her style of, like, getting information literally has inspired, like, half of the news networks we listen to today. Like, when you look at, like, I don't know, reportive journalism from, like, I don't know, the BBC or CNN, whatever you watch.
This is kind of
the pioneer of that.
This is kind of a tangent. I just watched the movie The Post the other week with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, and it's about the 1971 Supreme Court case, like the New York Times Covey, the United States.
Yeah.
About like the First Amendment and like the power of the press and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's a great movie if you haven't seen it. And it's about like the Washington Post, but yeah. Let's talk about it, especially because I feel like reporters today are like so under such scrutiny.
I'd say scrutiny.
I was about to say strict scrutiny, but I like couldn't get that out of my mind.
Oh yeah,
because that's a different thing.
Yeah, it's a legal thing.
Yeah, but I was like, it's strict scrutiny, but it's not. They're just like very, very like
questioned.
They're very, very questioned by this administration.
That's like the psychology of like fascism. Uh-huh. How like fascist dictators basically create a doubt in media, so any critique of them can just be like, oh no, sorry, that's not real. And that's not a call out, but if the shoe fits, wear it, I guess.
Yeah.
So once, and the other thing, if too leaders create like dishonesty within the media, which like honest, I get it to a certain extent, because I feel like before,
because also time, the media like, okay, is a court, like the media is a corporation. They are corporations. Yeah. They are for profit and things, and they do want the viewership. They do, like Joseph Pulitzer, sensation. This is a good thing to talk about. Joseph Pulitzer like, sensationalized almost all of his stories. Anything mm-hmm. that happened, like, it was sensationalized. It was this whole deal. That's always been a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it... It doesn't, like, discredit all of journalism, too. If that makes sense. Yeah. Like, even with this yellow journalism, sensationalism, whatever, that didn't stop Nellie Bly from exposing the horrors of Blackwell Asylum.
Right. I feel like it's important to know that one thing being false is an indict on everything else, you know?
Yes. You know what? Amen. Amen to this. This is... Sorry. I feel like we're back in our oats. We're feeling our oats
this episode. Yeah.
we're back in our just, like, people wanting to listen to these two kids just, like, give their theories about the corruption of the American government. Yeah.
And this is really what it is. We tell mm-hmm. stories and then we go on tangents. That's kind of
We go on tangents. And sometimes people enjoy that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's good and stuff. Well,
it works out. Mm-hmm. So, basically, what we can take away from this is, one, a story of a bad bleep.
We said that, like, three times.
Okay, but she deserve it? Yes.
Does she deserve it? Yes.
Who really, again, pioneered the journalism that we know today.
Uh-huh.
Was like, a woman. One of the coolest people of her time. And I'm sure inspired so many, like, women to, like, go into writing and just a lot of writers in general. I've never heard of her before, like, today when I wrote this.
I heard of her because of the Drunk History episode. And mm-hmm. she was in the A-Push textbook.
Was she really?
Yeah. So, yeah.
I don't remember her. Maybe that's why I got a 3.
Oh, that's okay. That's fine.
It's a little soon for me, actually. A
little soon, maybe, perhaps. Okay. Yeah. But, all things considered, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, what did we take away from today? Taylor, my sister just slipped out of the basement. She did not want to be in the video. It's like that, have you seen the video where it's like Madison Beer and she's like, I hate it when I say this, because then people on Twitter are like, you're lying, I hate you, but then she's like, I was supposed to be in the video, and everyone's like, oh my god!
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted you to be in it, actually.
Yeah. And then she's like, and I was like in Miami, I was like visiting my family, I hadn't seen them in a really long time, and I was like, I should just leave them.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no. So yeah.
So, yep.
Recap. Overall. Let's recap today like like it's a fire.
So basically, Blake told a story about this dam that broke because of corruption. Well, I would say corruption. Yeah, negligence, and a little bit of corruption. People not taking accountability. And then I told a story about a really cool feminist, Elizabeth, or mm-hmm. Nellie Bly, who revolutionized journalism and told people what they needed to hear mm-hmm. and uncovered corruption and said, you can't get away with that, and... Because of that, create a really cool legacy that we hold dear today.
Yeah.
And what you can take away from those stories is, one, for Blake's story, patronage, bad. If people, especially nepotism, also bad, those are kind of hand in hand, right? Uh-huh. Patronage and nepotism.
If you're not qualified for your job.
Don't do it, maybe. Mm.
And if...
Take accountability.
She got Senate approval. If you know who she is... She got Senate approval. I can't get over that. I have certificates that, like, have her fake signature on them.
Mm-hmm.
And she's out here being, like...
It's fine. No,
she's
it's
out
fine.
Here being, like, go.
It needs to happen.
I like her glasses. I need to say something positive about her. I like her. I respect her.
Her name's cool.
Her name is cool. I like her glasses. Her name is cool. But at the same time, you're doing this wrong.
Yeah.
Listen to the people who have to, like, do their jobs, and you're not letting them do mm-hmm. the jobs that they envision. So today was basically an episode about a man who maybe wasn't the best, and then a girl who absolutely was the best, and we have to stand her.
And called out the men that were not the best.
Yeah. Oh. Oh.
I have a lot of cute little one-liners on this episode.
Yeah.
Doing really well.
So yeah. We're back.
We're back.
We're back. We are free of our medical illnesses. We're free. We're not free of our college applications for mm-hmm. Catherine. But yeah. So thank you for joining us for this episode where we like got our groove back and we're vibing again. We hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions, be sure to hit us up on Twitter at @history_timepod. Thank you so much for watching. Catherine, do you have any final words?
Sit back, relax. And listen to another episode of his
go
story
back
time.
And like watch your favorite one or
yeah,
watch
rewatch it
rewatch
we need
your
the AdSense
we do need whoa. Okay. With that, thank you for watching. Be sure to tune in next week. Goodbye.